I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mike Lazzaro, co-founder of Buddy Media, a company that helps corporations connect with their customers using social media. Clients like IBM and JetBlue use Buddy Media's software to engage consumers through Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and other platforms. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Could you describe what Buddy Media does?
Sure. We're a software company, and a lot of companies are realizing that they need to reorganize around people. It used to be you couldn't really know what people were talking about across the internet. And before the internet, you had no idea unless they came into your store and said, I don't like your pizza, then you change your pizza, right? With the advent of Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and all these social networks, there's a lot of conversations that you can tap into, and we really help companies leverage those conversations by engaging with consumers so they can listen to what consumers are saying and then take actions that help engage them, whether it's, you know, launching their promotions if you're a Coca-Cola or Pepsi or Ford or GM, or if you're a more of a local business, you can you do discounts and, you know, give your customers tons of stuff. And all that's managed through our software platform.
Buddy Media is doing for corporations what Facebook did for consumers and for individuals.
Absolutely.
How much of what you do is really messages from the consumer to the company versus the company kind of pushing their product on the customer? How much is reciprocity?
For the last 1,000 years, all marketing was pushing. So it was creating a message and then pushing it onto consumers. I think with social media, you're no longer just the quarterback throwing. You're actually the wide receiver catching what your consumers are doing and running with it. Mm-hmm. So it's really two-way. And with Facebook at close to 1 billion people globally, all of a sudden you have a two-way communication platform at scale, mm-hmm. meaning one platform where the world has reorganized around. So you can listen and act on one platform. Then when you add Twitter and LinkedIn and YouTube and others, all of a sudden you have the ability to do this two-way communication at scale with the world's consumers. I mean, there are only three certainties in life: death, taxes, and advertising. And so we are never going to get away from advertising. And so, you know, I think we're in a world where kind of advertising is in the middle of the most radical shift it's seen in the 10,000 years that it's been around. And what's driving that is the ability to kind of get instantaneous feedback from customers, potential customers, their friends. All of a sudden, it's a relationship.
You founded this company in 2007 because you loved and love Facebook. Why did you love Facebook so much that it catalyzed you to start a company based on it?
Sure. Well, there have been a very few internet services which I've used over my 15 plus years on the internet that really enthralled me and grabbed me. So I remember the first time I searched on Google, I think we all put in our name, which was probably the first thing, and immediately every result comes back, like instantaneous. And when I went onto Facebook and started using Facebook, I realized that there are a lot of people who I actually really like who I don't pick up the phone and call and see often. And especially if you're a guy, I think, where we don't like talking on the phone. Like, it lets us keep in touch and see pictures of, you know, family and friends and their new babies in a really like seamless, efficient way. And this idea that you can keep in touch with people who in the past would have fallen out of your life and always stay connected was just a really powerful idea.
Why Facebook? There was MySpace and other, you know, potential competitors. What was it about Facebook that you decided to base your whole technology on them?
I was really one of the first members of this kind of digital generation. So I'd used all those services since college, and MySpace seemed like a great entertainment site, but it didn't hit me as an incredibly powerful and important movement in the world. When I used Facebook and I saw real friends, not in the internet business, people who sold insurance and real estate and teachers and financial advisors join Facebook and love it as much as I did, mm-hmm. I saw an engagement that you just didn't see with a lot of these other ones. And a big part of Facebook is it starts private. We're private people, and we let people into our lives based on how we want to control our information. That's just how we act as human beings. And that's what Facebook does. And starting private to private versus MySpace public to public, where everything is public, was huge.
To what extent were you looking for a new company to launch? Because you're a serial entrepreneur and you had a couple of successful launches prior to starting Buddy Media. So what part of it was like, you know, what's my next gig? And, you know, I like Facebook. Let me think about that versus, wow, it was sort of like an epiphany moment.
I think the best things happen in life when you're not looking for them. I wasn't looking to get married at 25. I met my wife and we fell in love and it just happened. So I never thought to myself, I need to get married. I'm going to go hunt for someone to marry. And at the same time, timing's everything. So we'd sold our last company a year before to Time Warner. We weren't working. We were doing consulting. We were doing kind of just helping friends out and colleagues out. And on May 24th, 2007, two things happened. One was Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook at the time, I think 21 years old, 22 years old, launched the Facebook platform, which was a radical opening up of the platform to developers. The second thing that happened was my third child was born, Vivian. And so, you know, Cass, my wife, had just had a C-section. I was sitting next to her as she was sleeping, looking at my BlackBerry. You know, I didn't have an iPhone back then. And I, you know, up pops a message, Facebook launches a platform, and it immediately hit me that it's one of the most powerful things to happen to the internet, this radical opening of a website and being able to build on top of this social graph, the virtual representation of these real-life relationships. And as we spoke about it, we had a mutual vision for, you know, this is how the internet is going. The last kind of 10 years of the internet was about utility and search, and the next kind of 10, 20, 30 is about people. And we decided just to jump in really without a business plan or anything, just because it felt right to us.
You mentioned social graph being?
So the social graph is something that's always existed. It's, you know, these real relationships we have. You know, think of it as a graph that you may be connected to 100 people, and each of those people are connected to 100 people. So it's just like this weave of relationships. And what Facebook did was they were the first company to create a virtual representation of that real-life social graph.
Your partner in launching these companies is your wife, is Cass. What was her reaction when you were sitting in the hospital room and you thought, you know, maybe this would be a great idea, starting a company to help corporations with their social media presence?
Well, she was sleeping and she just had major surgery, which was the C-section. So, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but I am smart enough to know that you don't pitch a new business to your wife the day she has a C-section. So it didn't happen immediately, but it did hit me very hard. And I think over the next few weeks, mm-hmm. as we were talking and looking at kind of where this is going, mm-hmm. we realized that there was an opportunity to start a business mm-hmm. to ride this wave of kind of connectivity. And yeah. we knew that the companies that got in early with Google and kind of helped companies market on Google, the same thing would happen on the open internet. Now, mm-hmm. Facebook at the time only had about 20 million people. So what we forget often is that at the time, no one knew Facebook would be as big as they are today. What's happened is we picked the right platform. So being in the right place at the right time and riding the wave early but not too early is really what put us in a position to be in, you know, the leadership position we are today.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mike Lazaro, co-founder of Buddy Media, a company that helps corporations connect with their customers using social media. He's a serial entrepreneur who formerly launched Golf.com, bought by Time Warner, and University Wire, an AP-like service for the university community. When you were 19 years old, you had heart surgery. You had a valve replaced. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, so it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. And I say that because I was born with a congenital heart defect. You know, luckily, I was born in these modern times and not a long time ago when they didn't know how to treat these things. And so I had a hole in my heart. It was a VSD, a ventricular septal defect, for those cardiologists out there. And when I was 19, it started expanding. And so they went in and they wanted to do two things. One is close the hole, but I also had some valve damage to my aortic valve, which is the largest valve in your heart. And so they went in and they put in an artificial heart valve and closed the hole. And 8 days later, you know, the valve basically burst and they had to repair it. So within 8 days, I had 2 surgeries. And I think when you have this near-death experience, which it was near death, like I should have been dead, it lets you appreciate everything else you have. Mm-hmm. And it turns all the other problems that you think you have into really not problems. Like, what's the worst thing that can happen? Like, I'm not dying.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So let's move on, right? But, you know, I've always had kind of quirky health stuff. So my heart, I've crossed eyes.
And you've had crossed eyes since you were born.
Yeah, crossed eyes since the beginning. I had 1 surgery, which they tried to fix it, but they didn't. I forget the name of the surgeon, but he wasn't very good, obviously, because it's still a cross.
You know, having crossed eyes, it impacts not just, you know, the way you see the world, but how people see you. I mean, it could be a distraction for people. And as a child, I would imagine the pressure, the social pressure that you might have received from it. How did having cross eyes affect your view of yourself?
I think I didn't really realize it until later in life. Because when you're young, you are who you are. I was very happy with who I was.
But did kids make fun of you because you had them?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I don't remember any kids making fun. And frankly, my closest friends today are people I knew when I was 5 or 6, growing up in D.C., and actually they live in New York now. It wasn't until, you know, I got into more social settings where, like, people don't know you're looking at them and you're kind of talking to them and they're kind of looking around like, are you talking to me? So you kind of compensate with that. It's why I'm so comfortable doing this radio interview and not TV. I don't love doing TV, even though I do it a lot, because I'm forced to look at cameras. And then the camera guy's like, no, look over here. I'm like, I am, but I have cross eyes. So, and they feel really bad. And I say, don't worry about it. It happens all the time.
Incidentally, do I see holes in your left ear?
No, it is a freckle that you see in the studio. I have never worn an earring, but maybe I will start after this.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mike Lazaro, co-founder of Buddy Media, a company that helps corporations connect with their customers using social media. We'll hear more from Mike coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mike Lazaro, co-founder of Buddy Media, a company that helps corporations connect with their customers using social media. Clients like IBM and JetBlue use Buddy Media's software to engage consumers through Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and other platforms. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. Parents were entrepreneurs for the most part. Now, I say parents were divorced, had step-parents and step-grandparents, very large family. And my mom was a public interest lobbyist for years for the American Association of University Women, and now with a leadership conference on civil rights. And so I had this blend of kind of public interest and do good for my mom with kind of self-starting entrepreneurship from my dad and stepdad, who owned their own businesses.
What were their businesses?
One was a developer. So my dad was a developer who then went on to own a home inspection company. And my stepfather had basically had one job his whole life, which was financial advisor in his own kind of boutique firm.
What were your interests growing up?
My interests were music, girls, sports, writing. I did high school newspaper and always liked the media. I felt like there's something kind of intriguing and powerful about print journalists primarily. But there was an interest in kind of how people made their own way in life. Mm-hmm. As my siblings went out and traveled and did kind of normal kid stuff, I worked during the summer. Mm-hmm. And how companies function and how you actually like worked and then got paid in return. Mm-hmm. Was like a fascinating idea. Like, wait, I just have to do this and then you give me money? Mm-hmm. Like, that's crazy, right? And then business, just you know, how business was done. I applied to be on the board of directors of the Sallie Mae Corporation when I was 13 years old. I don't know why they would have ever selected me. I thought they needed a student.
Why Sallie Mae?
I'd gotten a few shares for my bar mitzvah, I think. And it was with a stepfather who's a financial advisor, it seemed like a cool business, like student loans. Like, how could you not make money? To me, it's just like printed money. And I really had no idea what it did. But it's just this idea that, like, you could create, like, really big businesses by just coming up with an idea.
Just curious, what were your summer jobs?
You know, my mentor was a guy named Doug Bailey, who started something called the Political Hotline, which later launched a bunch of different publications. But it was a daily briefing for the political world. And it's what I did every summer until I was offered a job by Mort Kondracki at Roll Call, which is the newspaper Capitol Hill, to basically be an intern, where I basically reported. I mean, they were short-staffed. I, would dig through kind of financial disclosures of the congressmen and senators, and it just put me in a position of kind of not only understanding media, but like what it takes to work hard, which I think those times when other kids were potentially having fun were formative times, and I think it put me in a position to just have more perspective now.
You met your wife, Cass, and you got married in 1995 when, as you mentioned before, you weren't necessarily expecting to get married that early. What appealed to you about her?
Yeah, so we got married in 99. As I said, I wasn't looking to get married. There were very few people doing internet stuff at the time. So we met in 1996 at a wedding in Allentown, Pennsylvania. It was a very geeky industry. Today, it's cool to be in the internet business. People want to be in the internet business, and you have venture capitalists, and it's really tech is the new Hollywood. But at the time, there were a bunch of people trying to figure it out, and there was no money involved because like no one spent money on internet advertising. There wasn't e-commerce. And so we really bonded over that. She was doing her own stuff on the internet, building websites for law firms. Mm. And she was athletic. I thought she was gorgeous. I thought she was funky. I was living in Chicago. She was living in D.C. We did the long-distance relationship for a year. She moved to Chicago. And then, like all people who are dating, decided to start a business together. But we've been in the position of, growing really big businesses. And I think the reason why it's worked is we don't work together in the sense that what she does at the company with operations and finance and HR and rah-rah, like really getting the employees and the organization of the business moving forward is very different than building a product and finding revenue.
How did you decide to start a company together?
The first business felt so natural to us. She played college tennis and golf. She had a concept in the golf industry around tracking your handicap and recreational golf content. And I just thought it was a great idea. And this was back in like 98, and helped her get it off the ground. And then I said, listen, get a few partners on board, raise a little money, and I'll join. Before I know it, she did that. I had a belief back then that if you can't work with people you love, who do you work with? Do you work with people you hate or you can't get along with? And we always got stuff done very well together. And I don't worry about what she's doing. Like, she gets it done. She doesn't worry about what I'm doing. And like, that trust is really important in any relationship, whether you're a friend, whether you're business partners, whether you're lovers, whether you're married.
To some extent, probably your working together fueled the intimacy of your personal life.
I think at the beginning, it fueled how we connected and how we communicated. And as time went on, we had to really make our efforts to get away from work. Every Tuesday night and Saturday night are date nights. And, what brought us together, we realized very soon, could tear us apart if we don't set those boundaries. And frankly, right now, work probably isn't in the top three or four priorities. It's our marriage, our kids, our health, our friends, and then work.
What was the reaction among investors to, a husband and wife launching team? Because some, venture capitalists will say, I'll never fund a husband and wife team. What was the climate there?
Well, by some, I think you mean 99%. Like most people who, when we showed up, we said, you know, at the time, we weren't even married, right? Like, at least when you're married, you have a contract. We said, hey, we're together. We're launching this business. Do you want to invest? No, we don't do husband and wife teams. And it just made for shorter meetings. Now, success breeds success. So as we created bigger businesses, we had investors lining up to fund us. And, you know, if you're successful, it doesn't matter who you are, what your relationships are, what you look like. Investors will invest. They just want to make money.
How much was Golf.com sold for?
We sold it for $24 million, mm-hmm. which was a great outcome because we funded it. We only raised $2 million and at a decent valuation. So investors made a lot of money. We did very well. And it really, you know, was my second business that we exited successfully, and it paved the way for these other businesses.
Your first business was University Wire,
yep.
which was like an Associated Press among the university newspapers. How did that idea come about?
I was a student at Northwestern. I was at the journalism schools working on the college newspaper, and a very large portion of our content was coming from the Associated Press, stuff that had nothing to do with students. And so I said, why are we doing this? Why aren't we running content that matters to students?
You founded Buddy Media in 2007. Who were the initial investors at the company?
We put in the first money. We raised money from colleagues of ours, so just friends in the industry. The ones who, you know, are more public now are Peter Thiel, who's on the Facebook board, and Mark Pincus, who's the CEO of Zynga.
And Peter Thiel being the founder of PayPal.
Yeah, okay. And the founder of PayPal, and great businesses, you know, Founders Fund, like one of the top entrepreneurial minds, I think, of our generation. And from there, we raised more money, and, you know, more money, we were able to fund the dream, and now we're growing, you know, over 100% a year.
And a valuation of $500 million in 2011.
Yeah, that's what was reported.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mike Lazaro, co-founder of Buddy Media, a social media platform that helps corporations engage consumers through Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and other platforms. Was there one or two clients that you brought on board in the early days of Buddy Media that really helped to accelerate your getting other clients?
One was Starwood, the hotel company. Starwood has an issue with social, which is they have 1,000 products, 1,000 hotels in the marketplace. And so how do you respond and listen to what is happening on a property-by-property level across 1,000 hotels globally, every country, every language they do business in? And so they needed software to scale that. They can't throw people at 100 hotels and have – or 1,000 hotels and have 1,000 people doing this. And so we knew that they had a problem, which is how do you engage with consumers in this distributed network? What we've done with them very successfully is help them engage on a property-by-property level. So what that means is each hotel, like W Union Square in New York, which is close to here, they have a Facebook page that's on our software. So do 1,000 others. And so that hotel manager can talk about what specials are coming up, and they have a DJ in the lobby, and you know, when people say they're not having a great experience, they can get back to them right away. And so really on a local level, we've let them activate what's a very global platform, Facebook.
Are you ever annoyed when you get emails from corporations pushing things? You know, in theory, these are collaborative relationships, but still there's such an inundation of so-called engagement that, you know, it could be annoying to people.
I think the big shift that is underway is one in which you're not opting in to one in which you're opting in. So in email, you are buying through sites, you think just giving your email address for one use, and it's being traded, and before you know it, you can't use email anymore because you have so much spam coming in. We've all had this problem. How do we get through our inbox without deleting half of them because they're spam? On the other side, you have social networks where you have to let them in for them to get to you.
Right.
And so it's then about how can I give you as a consumer so much value that you will want to friend me on Facebook, that you'll want to like us on Facebook. And so it's about discounts, exclusive content, exclusive experiences. If you could get backstage tickets to your favorite band by just liking a page, if you could be sent to the Super Bowl from a big company just from liking a page and connecting on Facebook, you will do it for that trade-off. You never have that decision in email.
To what extent will spam kill email?
I don't think email will go extinct. I think it's a very useful utility in the right setting, and it's an efficient way to get things done. It's not the most social product. It's, you know, you're in and you're out. You're sending a message. You're waiting for a reply. It's asynchronous. It's not real time. It's, you know, it's a utility that has its purpose. But if you look at the amount of time spent on email over the last 5 years versus the amount of time spent just on Facebook, you've gone down significantly on email, especially among the younger generations. And you've seen Facebook and Tumblr and other sites take off. I mean, see growth that we've never seen in the media business.
You went to a conference recently hosted by the CEO of Salesforce.com, Mark Benioff, and you called it, by the way, a rock concert, which reminds me of your comment before where you said tech is the new Hollywood. Incidentally, why is tech the new Hollywood? What resonates with people that, you know, is really causing this to be so sexy?
Well, I think what Mark understood very early on was content ruled the world, and so he is the king of software companies these days. So Salesforce is a $20 billion business. And the reason, and big reason, is that he's always kind of engaged and staged great events. So Dreamforce, which was his, you know, national, really global event, the highlight was the Metallica concert, right? Where they pay Metallica. Who knows what you pay to come in? And so people are coming for networking, for the rock concert, for all of this event, these events and drama, but they're also learning about their products. So it's just great marketing. And so that's what you have to do as a business. If you just show up and talk about your business, people tune out.
Right. You know, and you've provided an example, rather than a stove company talking to you about their stoves, they should take the consumer view and talk to you about recipes that the consumer might want to use, you know, yeah, on the stove.
I mean, how many Nike commercials have you seen where they mention the shoes? Not many. Okay. They mention competition. They promote their running app, which lets you share your runs with your friends.
Nike Plus.
Nike Plus. So they're providing value to you as a consumer and getting the halo effect of doing that.
You've discussed, and others have discussed, this kind of shift from the consumer side of social to the enterprise side of social. Really, you know, instead of just social media being about consumers, you know, having the enterprise, these corporations also adopt social media. Why is there this lag? Why does it take enterprises longer to respond? Is it just because they're bigger ships?
It's not easy to change if you're a big company. Change takes time. It's scary. People feel fear for their jobs. And I think that this is such a fundamental shift in how companies operate, from kind of really you're hiding behind your ad campaigns. If you spend enough money, you can change your image. Today, you can't. It's all about your products, your services, you know, pleasing the consumer as they interact with you. And if you're a phony, you're going to get crushed. You know, I would argue that people weren't upset that Tiger Woods had affairs because he's Tiger Woods. They were upset that he was fake. He held himself up that he was such a stand-up guy, and that was all phony.
Corporations have needed to see the examples of the consumer side of social in order to buy in. One example of the public, you know, really taking advantage of social media is what happened in the Middle East, in the Muslim world.
Sure. So I think we would all agree that people weren't that happy in Egypt for many years. There was never a way to organize around that anger. And what these social platforms did is provide a very efficient way for people to organize and communicate and really share their feelings and realize that they weren't alone. And if they all banded together, like, their voice would be heard. And so the same thing's happening with companies, where if you make a mistake as a company, you hear about it.
And also, there's an area of shareholder activism, too. You have these public companies and, you know, shareholders, if you don't own a significant percent of the company, they're really insignificant constituents. But perhaps social media will give them more of a voice.
Technology lets anyone amplify their voice. It's not that people haven't been upset for years. It's that you're upset in a silo, where maybe you had dinner with someone and you all were upset together. But the collective upset, the collective action that's possible through these social platforms is what's changing the world in politics, in government, in education, and now in business.
We talk about, you know, consumer side of social media, and we talk about large corporations depending on social media. But then there's also, like, people becoming brands, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Tom Friedman at the New York Times. Tom Friedman is not glued to the New York Times anymore. He's his own brand. He Twitters.
Absolutely.
He's on Facebook. Have you ever thought about helping individuals manage their social media presence?
Yeah, so it's a great insight because I think what we've learned is everyone has their own brand. And so it's my belief that instead of worrying about privacy necessarily, worry about curating your brand. And curating your brand means that how do you bring so much value to the people around you that you're known for something, that you're memorable? The worst thing you can be in the social media world is unremarkable, is, you know, nameless. And so if you're selling insurance, you know, are you tweeting about the regulations? Are you tweeting about kind of what's going on in the industry? If you're selling real estate, are you kind of writing and sharing information about how you should think about the markets in your house? Everyone should be, I believe, should be thinking about what am I known for? How do I give value? Because what happens if you give more than you take, when it's time to ask for something from friends, they feel like it's okay. This isn't someone who's always asking. They're usually giving, so I'm going to do this. And that's important in life.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
My guest has been Mike Lazaro, co-founder of Buddy Media. Coming up, we'll meet Richard Saul Werman, founder of the TED Conference. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Richard Saul Werman, an architect, author, and creator of the TED Conference. TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, and every year the event brings together the world's leading innovators in Long Beach, California, and Oxford, England. Richard founded TED in 1984 and sold the company in 2002 to the entrepreneur Chris Anderson. Richard is the author of more than 80 books on subjects ranging from architecture to travel to healthcare. Richard is the creator of TEDMED and 1920-21, a project focusing on the effects of urban population growth. He lives in Newport, Rhode Island. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
How did you come up with the idea for TED?
First of all, TED has an image today, and I don't want to be holding on to somebody. I sold TED.
In 2002.
And Chris Anderson has taken over and made an enormous success, further success, than I ever did or would ever be able to. He's TEDified the world with what he has done because he's made it with June Cohen, who created the TED Talks. He has expanded the audience of the 18-minute talk that I created and am now disowning, and has made it a worldwide phenomena. And I know in many Google alerts and many citations on my, if you Google me, it says, you know, creator of TED, and that's the truth. I created TED. What I think I created, however, was just an observation that's such an old observation now, which was new when I created it.
What is it?
The old news is that there was, in 1984, a convergence that I saw that the world hadn't yet between technology business under the entertainment industry and the design professions.
What's an example?
Any great design, a building, makes use of technology, the new technologies. Look at what Frank Gehry is doing, which is based on computer technology and computer imaging from Dassault Corporation to do his buildings. Are Frank's buildings entertaining? I did a conference. Nobody knew what I was talking about. Few people came, and I lost money.
How large was that initial meeting?
I papered the room a little bit, but it was probably 300 people.
And
but
did you plan it to be an ongoing conference
never.
Or just
no,
a
I didn't.
One,
no,
one
no,
shot
no, no.
deal?
No, I was just doing it. Just doing it once.
And
like I do most things once.
So how did it escalate into what it's become even before Chris bought
it? Oh, before Chris bought it, 1,000 people came every year, was sold out 2 years in advance, and it had become a love fest.
How?
Because I did it well.
Did you do the marketing well? Did you
do any
the
marketing.
Content
no, no,
well?
No, 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 no. Look.
I know you say you don't do marketing.
I don't do
so
any
what
marketing.
Did you do well?
I really, there's no marketing, there's no advertising, and there's no PR.
Okay? So what did you do well?
I ran a gathering that I would want to be in the front row. The speeches weren't too long to bore me. There was no podium, so you couldn't read a speech. I turned off your mic if you sold anything from the stage. I invited wonderful people. I had wonderful music. I had animal acts. I had Dale Chihuly's glassworks. I had everything wonderful there. Everything that I wanted to see, it assuaged my curiosities, and it still does.
How did you come up with the 18 minutes initially?
It was about where I just heard somebody talking. I said, that's as long as I can listen. Nothing scientific. I had to come up with some number.
You'd never expected that it would become what it has become, partly
never.
Because of Chris Anderson's acquisition of it. But you mentioned that you thought it was so successful because it was good. The content was so good. The speakers were so good. But was there some kind of turning point that caused it to really gain the public's attention?
I never gave press passes, first of all. The first time I ever gave press passes was when I knew Chris was buying it, and I was going to turn it over to him, so I let press in the year 2002. Were there stories about it? Yeah, but they had to pay their way in. I thought, why should I give him a free seat when he's going to make money from writing the article?
And how much did Chris pay for TED?
You can look that up.
I looked it up, $14 million.
I didn't answer the Wall Street Journal, and I won't, not the Wall Street Journal, I didn't answer the New York Times, and I won't answer you because I'm not supposed to say how much it was sold for.
I've heard that it was roughly $14 million. Was this a turning point for you financially?
No. Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, I had sold two or three companies before that.
What were the companies?
Access Press, a guidebook company, Understanding Business, mm-hmm. a company where we did all the phone books in California. I did an Olympic book that sold 3.5 million copies. The turning point was that I had done 20 TED conferences, and I thought that was enough. I didn't know how much I'd miss it mm-hmm. after I sold it. But before I sold it, I thought that was enough.
What are some of the most memorable occurrences at TED? Some of the most memorable speakers for you?
I did a TED event in Kobe, Japan. I had the greatest jazz pianist from Japan and the greatest jazz pianist in the world play jazz together 300 miles apart. I convinced NTT, Nippon Telephone and Telegraph, I convinced the chairman of the board to spend more than $250,000 to wire fiber optics cable from Tokyo to Kobe, an island conference center. Had four great Yamaha disc claviers that had just come out, two in Tokyo, two in Kobe, and big television screens in both places so they could see each other and the audience could see each one playing. And they played for over an hour. A great jazz piece together that they had never met before. Herbie Hancock and Makoto Azone. I was given a lot of bad vibes, a lot of nasty things said to me when I invited Billy Graham to come, and he gave a wonderful talk to a standing ovation, and he made me cry. And I didn't think that would occur. I had an amazing young man who had gotten out of Tiananmen Square from China. He was 23 at the time. He was one of the heads of the student groups, if not the head of all the student groups. Sherwin Nuland, the author who wrote On Death and Dying, who's had many books on the bestseller list of the New York Times, and he outed himself. He outed himself about his depressions that he had in his 30s, that they were going to lock him up for life in an institution, and he convinced him, because he was a doctor, to give him electroshock therapy, and that he convinced him to give it 10 times to him, the limit is usually 3, and how it basically cured him and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. There's stories there's 1,000 stories.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Richard Saul Wurman, an architect, designer, author, creator of the TED Conference. Richard wrote his first book in 1962 when he was 26 years old. Richard is the creator of TEDMed, focusing broadly on medical issues, and 1920-21, a project focusing on urban population growth. You originally were an architect.
I am an architect. I don't think you stop being something you were trained for.
What originally sparked your interest in architecture?
I was a painter. And in high school, that's all I could think of doing. My father, who was a cigar maker, he knew somebody who was the president of a small college in Pennsylvania, and whose doctorate was in testing. So he tested me for 2 days. And it came out that the things I was highest in were archaeology, architecture, and hairdressing. So since I was 18, I've always cut my own hair. But I went into architecture because I realized that from architecture, I could always go into art. And from architecture, I could always go into archaeology. And so I went to the University of Pennsylvania because I heard of it was the best school in the United States at that time. And it was my life, and it still is my life.
Your father was a cigar maker. And on your mother's side, what did they do?
They were kosher butchers. Very, very simple people. My grandfather lived in this country for 60 years and never learned how to read English.
So after you graduated from college, you worked in architecture. What did you do specifically?
The only two jobs I had that I guess I wasn't fired from was Lou Kahn and Charles Eames, the designer. So those are the only two jobs I had, two masters, two gurus, two people I think of all the time still now, even though they're long dead. So I worked for him, and I had my own office, my own practice with two other architects that I met at the University of Pennsylvania. And I wasn't and probably still am not very good employee. We're having to base my life on the obtaining of clients. So we were in practice for about 13 years, but it wasn't good times.
While you were working in the field of architecture, did you have various side projects going on at the same time for the 20 or so years that you were working in that field?
Oh, always. It's my ignorance, it's my inabilities and my curiosity that has driven me to do so many things sideways. Finding patterns, finding things missing in patterns is what new ideas come from. And my daily exercise is thinking about those things. Never, ever trying to make a better version of something that doesn't work. Always going to the land called zero. That's the map in my head, the zero place of how to begin again. So maps, architecture, ideas, healthcare, every subject that I'm interested in, whether it's the Olympics or it's dogs, I always try to figure out the zero place. I didn't start my architectural practice till after I'd done two books, and I was teaching in North Carolina. I had to do even more a year, every year, and without publishers. Nobody's ever asked me to do a book, and nobody's ever asked me to do a conference. I don't know why. I would like to be wanted, but that has not been part of my life. And so either I railroad my things past the point where anybody can ask me, or actually people don't care me doing things and don't want to publish. I don't know which one. But the fact is, the thing that seems so envious from the people on the outside, oh, you get to do whatever you want, is actually it's not been pleasant often, and it's total vulnerability and risk-taking.
When did you feel that you weren't wanted? Even growing up in social life, did you feel ostracized by kids in your class, for example?
No. Friends that I know from grammar school have said one thing that I found strange but can understand now a little bit more. And they said the one thing that they feel of how I am different than how they've turned out is that I'm the same as I was in second grade, that I haven't changed. Perhaps it's my immaturity that has been useful. And I know on my jar of ashes I would like to have the first line I wrote on the second book I did of Lou Kahn, and there I said, he was the youngest person I ever knew. And that would be okay for me to have on my urn. I think comes with that immaturity is the desire to be wanted and curiosity and why. Why? I don't understand. Please. And it's that innocence inside of a grisly, curmudgeonly body that is the contrast of my life.
Would you say that you are that your body is grisly and curmudgeonly?
Well, I've just taken off a great deal of weight in the last 2 years, so it's not so grisly.
And you lost almost 100 pounds.
Well, it's 90. It's a big difference between 90 and 100.
What was the impetus for saying, okay,
I had just had a very good physical. I get a physical every 6 months and have for many, many years. And so I knew the doctor wasn't going to tell me to do anything. And so I thought it was time. to do it myself, because had he told me, I wouldn't have been able to do it. I didn't do any exercise to take off weight, meaning I just ate less.
You know, we talk about just your insatiable curiosity really driving projects, regardless of whether publishers are going to publish your works. And your wife has described your brain as a great big cellular Cuisinart, mixing all his knowledge, thoughts, frustrations, observations, visual, conceptual, and gathered information and feelings about everything together.
I don't look at myself in that, in those terms. Do you look at your, can you possibly look at yourself in terms that would are like that? I know I'm curious. I know I'm stupid. I know I like thinking up new ideas. I don't think I've just fallen off the turnip truck. I am not attached to the things from that I've done. I don't have copies of all my books. I'm really attached to the thing I'm about to think up.
What's the motivation for writing so many books?
My ignorance. I'll tell you a short story, very short. A woman lives in Santa Fe, opens up an incredible restaurant that's quite successful on Southwest cooking, goes to New York and gets a big advance from a publisher to do a book on Southwest cooking. I go through Santa Fe, stop at her restaurant and others, like the food, go to the same publisher in New York and say, amazing food in Santa Fe. I don't know anything about it. I'd like an advance to do a book about Southwest cooking. Of course, I wouldn't get an advance. But my book would be better. And the reason it would be better, even though I was selling my ignorance, is because my book would be about the journey from not knowing to knowing. And that's a more interesting journey to the one-off book from the expert. That's a fundamental difference in my life.
How did you make enough money to support yourself to engage in these various projects? And I'm talking even before you founded TED in 1984. A family of cigar makers and butchers can only earn so much money.
I have no family money. Each project has its own little weird story. There's no model. There's no specific patron. But sometimes I'll convince some company who probably shouldn't even do it to give me some money to do something they don't even know what I'm going to do. So maybe it's a kind of acerbic charm, but it's a different story each time. And I've been down and out financially until quite late in my life.
You mentioned that you had humble means for a while, that you really were scraping bottom for,
for a while. My architectural practice went out of business. I was fired from a series of jobs. I was dean of a school and I was fired. I was didn't know what to do. I have no skill sets. I'm unemployable. All of a sudden, I kept on, probably sort of when I married my second wife, if somehow at the end of every year, we had a little bit more money than the beginning of the year. I'm a survivor. I begged my way across the United States. I lived in the jungle of Guatemala.
Is there anything that holds you back?
My intelligence, lack of, my personality. I think I probably am abrasive, or people maybe think I'm a loose cannon or something like that. I don't think I am. I think I'm extremely disciplined and not that, but I understand how I affect people.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Richard Saul Wurman, an architect, author, and creator of the TED Conference, TEDMED, and 192021. In 192021, how would you describe what that is?
192021 is a clever name that you won't forget, which stands for 19 cities of the world that will have more than 20 million people in the 21st century. The 192021 project is a major cardiographic initiative, a major mapping initiative. No two cities in the world do their maps to the same scale or with the same legends. Legends meaning how they designate land use. But even more important, there is no methodology for describing the borders to cities. Virtually every major city, and not even the biggest, every major city has spilled across its borders. They go past the political boundaries. And unless you have a methodology for describing that line, then you don't know within what area do you collect information.
Maps, I think, are works of art to some extent, and with their patterns and colors.
Well, they're works of art. They for a long time represented power because they represented understandable information. So there was battles fought over a map. Map, you could say, stands for MAP, man's ability to perceive. It's the fundamental underpinning of how we make information architecture. But maps, and again, the broadest sense, if you cut me in half, it's a map of my body. If you show a company and how it's done over the years, it's kind of a map of their financial success. So map is a pattern made understandable. I'm going to leave you with something. The largest mammal on Earth today is the blue whale. Blue whale gets to be about 120 feet, but I'm going to tell you how to know the size of a blue whale. Its heart is as big as a Volkswagen Beetle, and its tongue is as big as a bus. You'll never forget that. And neither will any child you tell, or any grown-up. So you only understand something relative to something you understand.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, my young lady.
My guest has been Richard Saul Wurman, an architect, author, and creator of the TED Conference, TEDMED, and 192021. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.